The Song of Seven Cities by Rudyard Kipling. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Song of Seven Cities. I was lord of cities, very sumptuously builded. Seven roaring cities paid me tribute from afar. Ivory their outposts were, the guardrooms of them gilded, and garrisoned with Amazons invincible in war. All the world went softly when it walked before my cities. Neither king nor army vexed my peoples at their toil. Never horse nor chariot irked or overbore my cities. Never mob nor ruler questioned whence they drew their spoil. Banded, mailed, and arrogant from sunrise unto sunset, singing while they sucked it, they possessed the land at large. Yet when men would rob them, they resisted, they made onset, and pierced the smoke of battle with a thousand-sabred charge. So they warred and trafficked only yesterday my cities. Today there is no mark or mound of where my cities stood, for the river rose at midnight, and it washed away my cities. They are evened with Atlantis and the towns before the flood. Rain on rain-gorged channels raised the water levels round them. Freshet backed on freshet swelled and swept their world from sight, till the emboldened floods linked arms and flashing forward drowned them, drowned my seven cities and their peoples in one night. Low among the alders lie their derelict foundations, the beams wherein they trusted and the plinths whereon they built. My rulers and their treasure and their unborn populations, dead, destroyed, aborted, and defiled with mud and silt. The daughters of the palace, whom they cherished in my cities, my silver-tongued princesses, and the promise of their May. Their bridegroom of the Juntide all have perished in my cities, with the harsh and venomed virgins that can neither love nor play. I was lord of cities, I will build anew my cities, seven, set on rocks above the wrath of any flood. Nor will I rest from search till I have filled anew my cities with peoples undefeated of the dark enduring blood. To the sound of trumpets shall their seed restore my cities, wealthy and well weaponed, that once more may I behold. All the world goes softly when it walks before my cities, and the horses and the chariots fleeing from them as of old. End of the Song of Seven Cities by Rudyard Kipling. Bay of Seven Islands by John Greenleaf Whittier. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Bay of Seven Islands. The skipper sailed out of the harbour mouth, leaving the apple bloom of the south, for the ice of the eastern seas, in his fishing schooner Breeze. Handsome and brave and young was he, and the maids of Newbury sighed to see his lessening white sail fall under the sea's blue wall. Through the northern gulf and the misty screen of the Isles of Mingan and Madeline, St. Paul's and Blaine Sablon, the little breeze sailed on. Backward and forward along the shore of lorn and desolate Labrador, and found at last her way to the Seven Islands Bay. The little hamlet, nestling below great hills white with lingering snow, with its tin-roofed chapel stood half hid in the dwarf spruce wood. Green-turfed, flower-sown, the last outpost of summer upon the dreary coast, with its garden small and spare, sad in the frosty air. Hard by where the skipper's schooner lay, a fisherman's cottage looked away, over isle and bay, and behind, on mountains dim defined. And there twin sisters, fair and young, laughed with a stranger guest, and sung in their native tongue the lays of the old provincial days. Alike were they, save the faint outline of a scar on Suzette's forehead fine, and both, it so befell, loved the heretic stranger well. Both were pleasant to look upon, but the heart of the skipper clave to one. Though less by his eyes than heart, he knew the twain apart. Despite of alien race and creed, well did his wooing of Marguerite speed, and the mother's wrath was vain as the sister's jealous pain. The shrill-tongued mistress her house forbade, and solemn warning was sternly said by the black-robed priest, whose word as law the hamlet heard. But half by voice and half by signs, the skipper said, "A warm sun shines on the green-banked Merrimack. Wait, watch, till I come back. And when you see from my masthead the signal fly of a kerchief red, my boat on the shore shall wait, come when the night is late." Ah, weighed with childhood's haunts and friends, and all that the home sky overbends, did ever young love fail to turn the trembling scale? Under the night on the wet sea sands, slowly unclasped their plighted hands, one to the cottage hearth, and one to his sailor's berth. What was it the parting lovers heard? Nor leaf, nor ripple, nor wing of bird, but a listener's stealthy tread on the rock moss, crisp and dead. He weighed his anchor and fished once more by the black coastline of Labrador, and by love and the north wind driven, sailed back to the island seven. In the sunset glow the sisters twain saw the breeze come sailing in again. Said Suzette, "Mother dear, the heretic sail is here."
"Go, Marguerite, to your room and hide. Your door shall be bolted," the mother cried,
while Suzette, ill at ease, watched the red sign of the breeze. At midnight, down to the waiting skiff, she stole in the shadow of the cliff, and out of the bay's mouth ran the schooner with maid and man. And all night long, on a restless bed, her prayers to the Virgin Marguerite said, and thought of her lover's pain, waiting for her in vain. Did he pace the sands? Did he pause to hear the sounds of a light step drawing near? And as the slow hours passed, would he doubt her faith at last? But when she saw through the misty pane the morning break on a sea of rain, could ever her love avail to follow his vanished sail? Meantime the breeze, with favouring wind, left the rugged Moisic hills behind, and heard from an unseen shore the falls of Manitou roar. On the morrow's morn, in the thick grey weather, they sat on their reeling deck together, lover and counterfeit of hapless Marguerite. With a lover's hand from her forehead fair, he smoothed away her jet-black hair. What was it his fond eyes met? The scar of the false Suzette. Fiercely he shouted,
"Bear away, east by north, for Seven Isles Bay."
The maiden wept and prayed, but the ship her helm obeyed. Once more the bay of the isles they found, they heard the bell of the chapel sound, and the chant of the dying sang in the harsh wild Indian tongue. A feeling of mystery, change, and awe was in all they heard and all they saw. Spellbound the hamlet lay in the hush of its lonely bay. And when they came to the cottage door, the mother rose up from her weeping sore, and with angry gestures met the scared look of Suzette.
"Here is your daughter," the skipper said. "Give me the one I love instead."
But the woman sternly spake,
"Go see if the dead will wake."
He looked, her sweet face still and white, and strange in the noonday taper light. She lay on her little bed, with a cross at her feet and head. In a passion of grief the strong man bent down to her face, and kissing it went back to the waiting breeze, back to the mournful seas. Never again to the Merrimac, in Newbury's homes that bark came back, whether her fate she met on the shores of Carriquet, Miscou or Tracadie, who can say? But even yet at Seven Isles Bay is told the ghostly tale of a weird unspoken sail. In the pale sad light of a northern day, seen by the blanketed Montenay, or squaw in her small kayak crossing the spectre's track. On the deck a maiden wrings her hands, her likeness kneels on the grey ghost sands, one in her wild despair, and one in the trance of prayer. She flits before no earthly blast, the red sign fluttering from her mast, over the solemn seas, the ghost of the schooner Breeze.
End of Bay of Seven Islands by John Greenleaf Whittier.
Seven Sprays by Juliana Townsend. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Seven Sprays. Seven sprays of pussy willow, each one has a little bed, each one has a little pillow, none of them are red. Seven sprays of pussy willow, some of them are grey, this little baby bird chased the old winter away. End of Seven Sprays by Juliana Townsend.
The Seven Joys of Reading by Mary Wright Plummer. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.
The Seven Joys of Reading. We must all have noticed a certain change of late in the attitude of the librarian and the library assistant toward books. Whereas the time was when books were regarded as things to be entered, catalogued, classified, shelf-listed, and then given out in as great numbers as possible to a more or less willing public, and the numbers reported with pride to the professional journals, it seems now to have occurred to the majority, as it had never failed to present itself to the minority, that books are also to be read, that, in fact, that is what they are for. In the days when the slogan of the librarian was the glib cry, "The librarian who reads is lost," and to stop classifying or cataloguing a book, or even to want to stop for a dip into its pages, was a positive crime, the librarians in this country were being led astray by a misquotation, or rather a garbled quotation, for Mark Pattison's words were these, in speaking of Casaubon, the great classical scholar who was made librarian to Henry IV of France.
"The use which he made of the library was one which no librarian ought to make. It was to read the books. He did nothing for arranging or cataloguing, hardly anything for publishing new texts. He never made any thorough or complete investigation of what was there, much less a catalogue. The librarian who reads is lost."
Which, as you see, is quite a different thing from the banner under which we went marching so long. There were many Protestants in our procession, murmuring from time to time, "This isn't the main track," or crying, "We're lost, we're lost," and pointing in another direction, miles away, where a much larger procession, that of the public we had been serving, was going gaily along with flags and music and banners and all the signs of enjoyment, everyone with a book, and often two, as many as we had been able to get him to carry, in fact. Not much attention was paid to these protests, however, until nearly all the questions about cataloguing and classification and records and methods had been settled or had almost settled those who discussed them. And in the lull many voices were heard saying, "Well, what shall we do next with the books?" Then some long-suffering scholar librarian with his pet edition of Horace or Virgil in his pocket suggested grimly, "Suppose we read them?" It was a brilliant idea, and the first manifestation of its popularity has come in the form of the Book Symposium, a delightful occasion for everyone who likes or prizes a book to give his reasons, or, if he pleases, just stand up and enthuse about it. Everybody who is fond of a book is only too glad to listen, for some day his turn will come and his pet book will have its innings. And what a jolly procession the Book Symposium is making of us! "I'm so glad you talked about these essays. I'm so fond of them." Or, "I never read that biography he spoke of, but I'm going to get it the very first time it is in," etc., etc. Where questions of cataloguing and accessioning led to puckered brows and worried faces. A comparison of favorite authors seems to wake everyone up and set everyone smiling. We are finding that many of us have always loved books, by stealth, as it were, not wishing to be considered lost by Mark Pattison or any of his misquoters. It is as if a new charter of liberties had been put into our hands. We are free to read, and read openly, and need no longer pretend that we read everything long ago, before we became librarians and found something more important to think of. And whereas it was once the fashion to smile in a superior way over the young person who thought herself qualified to enter a library school because she loved books and had read a great many good ones, we are really beginning to admit that that is a qualification after all. One of the city libraries of New England for some years past has actually spent money in printing in its bulletin the personal opinions of some of the staff about the new books and new editions added, which shows, when you come to think of it, that they must have read the books more or less. In a way, this could be justified even to those who think the reading of books too frivolous for a serious librarian, for this acquaintance with the books enables the editor of the bulletin to say such charming things about them as to make the public want to take them out, and that, of course, is justification enough. A second library is following the bulletin model of this one, and any day we may see a third or a fourth, though a good example is not so catching as bad, it is said. Lately, this same New England library was gone so far as to publish a list of its modern poetry, and under the leading names to quote such admirably chosen stanzas as to make of the list a fascinating little anthology of the editor's special favorites, let us say. And so, although the new fashion is as yet on trial, I am emboldened to say a word or two on what I shall call the seven joys of reading. Of course, there may be more. There may be 70 times 7, I could think of more myself probably, but I know there are 7. Some of these come when we are children, long before we do much thinking about our reading, and when it is still a purely sensuous enjoyment, and the first is the joy of familiarity. Who that has watched the storytelling of today has not seen the little bits of children smile all over their faces and begin to hug themselves as the storyteller began, "Once upon a time there were a king and a queen," and so in reading the story. You knew that story, and you knew it was good, and as you went on and came to this turn in the plot and that ever-to-be-remembered speech, you could have squeezed the very type for pleasure. It was the joy of familiarity that made you like to read about little Susie, in one after another of 6 more volumes, and about little Prudy, and then about all her family, one by one. You did not have that chill in opening a new one of a series that you felt when you first opened an entirely new book and had to move to a new town and meet a lot of strange people. After you had read such a book, you came back to the old ones and felt warm and comfortable again, and screwed yourself all up into a knot in the corner by the fire and read them all over for the 4th or 5th time. We are but children of a larger growth, and to this day there are some of us who periodically take down David Copperfield, or The Mill of the Floss, or Henry Esmond, or Emma, or Barchester Towers, and refresh our memories of old friends, yes, and of old foes, who at Christmas time think we must read the Christmas Carol for old sake's sake, who turn away from the modern songster chirping in every magazine and go back to Thanatopsis, or In Memoriam, or Snowbound, to hear the familiar lines rolling in like waves, one after another, in their well-known cadence. Of course, there are some books that are born old, such as Joseph Vance, for instance. As we read that, there came gradually upon us such a haunting sense of familiarity that we were convinced it had been known to us and loved by us in some previous state of existence. There was none of the chill of the untried, the discomfort of adjustment to a new writer, a new theme, a new way of seeing things. The joy of familiarity comes not alone from novels and poems. You can turn at the right moment, and there are mental as well as physical settings for such enjoyments, to many an essay the pages of which show that that is where the book has been opened most often. Don't say that you have not, more times than one, on a cool winter Sunday, when dinner is late than usual, used the dissertation and roast pig as an appetizer, or that you have not found satisfaction for an oft-recurring mood of wanting you know not what, in some perfect piece of writing such as Pater's Child in the House, or that, feeling limp and languid, you have not time and again breathed in Emerson's self-reliance like a draught of salt sea air. One knows where to go for the remedies needed for one's constitution. One does not try new prescriptions when the old ones have always answered, and in one's mental and emotional medicine chest, the old specifics hold their own. This for homesickness, that when you need bracing, the other to make you gay, and the fourth to give you a sense of comfort and cosiness, and rest you for your next sally into the cold world. The second joy is the joy of surprise, and this too belongs in a measure to childhood, when everything is new and the trick of weaving plot is unsuspected. Do you remember when the wandering prince or princess, tired and hungry and cold, lost in the dark wood at nightfall, appealed to you as in so dreadful a case that you didn't see how it was ever to be mended? And then suddenly came the life-saving solution. He saw a light. Oh, that light that twinkles in the pages of fairy tales! What a big sigh of relief it affords one! How clever it was of the old storytellers to save it for the last emergency! It meant shelter and warmth and food and probably friends, though we did find sometimes that even bands of robbers flourished deceptive lights that lure to danger. The joy of surprise for us older ones lies not in new books, not in the discoveries and inventions and new theories that fill the modern page. To all this we are hardened. Proof. Nothing of that kind can surprise us. It lurks instead in the old book. We pick up a volume and hear Pliny talking about lecturers in old Rome. "We approach the hall," he says, "as if compelled by main force. Many of us sit outside the door and try to overcome the ennui by discussing the gossip of the town. Messengers are surreptitiously sent in to inquire whether the lecturer has really made his appearance, whether he has finished his prologue, or how many sheets are still left to be read. Then, when we hear that the moment of deliverance is not very far off, we come in slowly, sit on the edge of our chairs, and do not even wait for the end of the discourse to slip or steal quietly away. The lecture-ridden reader of today at once feels a surprised kinship with the old Roman that nothing can weaken. We take up Job and hear him say to his comforters, 'Oh, yes, you know it all, of course.' Only, as Job put it, it was, 'No doubt but ye are the people, and wisdom shall die with you.' We find with Emerson's farmer that Plato has got 'some of my ideas.' And in Chaucer, we find literary a bit of modern slang, 'come off,' used in much the same sense, while Shakespeare says, 'And my good angel, fire my bad one out.' The surprise of finding human nature always human nature, ever since there is any record of humanity, of finding that truths that we think modern have been apprehended or glimpsed by the ancients, and sometimes grasped fully and examined on all sides, of learning that love and friendship and compassion are as old as the hills, is one of the rewards that await him who reads old books. He feels that he could take issue with Aeschylus, split hairs with Plato, quarrel with Lord Bacon, be instructed by Leonardo, and smoke with Raleigh, if only he had them here, with such common meeting ground as he has found in their written words. And his respect for Solomon grows apace, who knew and said that there was nothing new under the sun. The social reformer, in particular, must have this joy of surprise when he looks over an old book. From the days of the bricks without straw to Piers Plowman and the cry of the children, literature is full of the oppression and injustice and unfairness that he is so prone to consider the special sin of his own generation. What the surprise one might experience in discovering that these were all ages old and worldwide could be called a joy is perhaps doubtful, but it makes one feel a little less guilty personally. When the epidemic of influenza first reached this country and was characterized as a mysterious new malady, I came across a description of it in a letter of Campbell, the poet, written in 1803, with a surprise that was relief, if not exactly joy. It had happened before then, and people were not frightened to death, and the world had survived after all. A few years ago, a strange figure appeared in my office, a little man, a foreigner, of Hebrew race, I judged, who offered for sale very simply a volume of philosophy of his own writing, printed by some third-rate printer, cheaply bound and in no way attractive. The author told me he was a cobbler, if I remember aright, but he had thought out this book, and by great economy had managed to get it printed. Ordinarily, a librarian makes short shift of book peddlers. But there was something in this case that made me buy the book without any reference to its merits, something in the man himself that forbade me to disappoint him. I watched for notices of it, not being myself a judge of philosophical writings. A long review of it appeared after a time. Imagine the astonishment that must have been a joy of the reviewer when he found as he read that this uneducated cobbler, who had never read and probably never heard of Spinoza, had worked out a similar philosophy, was as original a thinker in fact as Spinoza. Had he been first, he would have been as famous. This very rare surprise of finding something unusual where one expects the average and the ordinary belongs to new books with reputations as yet unmade, and the joy of surprise is mingled with the joy of discovery and the joy of proprietorship that comes by right of discovery. There is nothing at such times that one wants to do so much as to get upon a fence or a stone and crow. The third joy is that of sympathy. There are all kinds of sympathy, including that of a perfectly good tooth with one that aches. It is not only of this kind that one feels like using Mark Twain's anathema, "Darn such sympathy," for there is the author who won't let us off without a few pages of pathos, who deliberately walks us up to the weeping point. We can see the memorandum in his notebook, "Make 'em cry in this chapter," and who makes it absolutely impossible to the tender-hearted to read certain passages aloud. One dislikes very much to sit in a subway train and sob, or to have one's voice give way when one is reading aloud to one's family, yet these are the humiliations that this kind of sympathy puts upon one. In childhood it was a different thing. Then we loved to cry, and deliberately read over again the chapter that excited our lacrimal glands. We are not so easily worked upon now as in the days of little Eva and Beth March and Louis last term at St. Mary's. Though some of our childhood favourites have the power of wringing a few tears from us still if they catch us in an impressionable moment, but we no longer find this kind of sympathy a joy. The power of fiction is perhaps in no time better demonstrated than when we take sides with the character against the author, accusing him of cruelty, unfairness, and lack of sympathy with one or another of his creations. Someone complained to George Eliot that she had been cruel to poor Hetty in Adam Bede. "If I had not made her pitiful, you could not have pitied her," was the reply. Many times, as I have read Martin Chuzzlewit, I find myself still scanning every line referring to the detestable Jonas for some redeeming trait, hoping against hope that he may prove less black this time than previous readings have shown him to be. The feeling is akin to that I had as a child in rereading a book with a tragic ending, that perhaps now it would turn out differently. However, neither is this the kind of sympathy that is a joy. It is indeed rather an anxiety. The joy lies in finding in a writer one who would evidently be congenial to us if we knew him, who sees with us, who does not rub us the wrong way, who does not explode fireworks at our ear nor lay traps for our feet, but goes along at the pace we like best, turning aside just where we would turn aside if left to ourselves, and coming neck and neck with us to a common conclusion. This sympathy goes out chiefly to the essayists, though occasionally a biography or an autobiography is so happily written that one feels one has met a real personality and found a friend. Dr. Johnson and Charles Lamb are the two examples that come at once to one's mind as authors arousing this peculiar personal sympathy, and every librarian must have the same feeling on reading Protheroe's Life of Henry Bradshaw. It is literally true that there is companionship in books when one finds the author who is simpatico, as the Italians say, and I can imagine a deaf person, or one cut off in some other way from congenial human society, actually finding his friends between the pages of his books. Even in life, the best friendships are based not so much on propinquity and contact as on the touching of minds and spirits. And this is almost completely obtainable in a book, not quite because there can be no dialogue, one must be simply a listener, so that talk really is best, but failing the ability to talk together because of a few thousand miles of distance or a few hundred years of time, the next best thing is to have a friend to whom one can listen and whose spiritual portrait, at least, one can discern. The fourth joy is the joy of appreciation, one that belongs to our maturer years and concerns itself chiefly with the way of saying things. There are refrains that seize us powerfully with some haunting quality and sing themselves in our ears all day, quick turns of speech that bring a responsive smile, the use of an old word in a new and exactly fitting sense that gives an unaccountable thrill of pleasure, a dainty exactness of definition or description that is wholly satisfying, word pictures that have all the color and vividness of those on canvas, and we linger over the lines, tasting and retasting and wondering why we cannot say things so, since we so enjoy them when others say them. The subtly funny things that you do not see until you have passed them, like violet hunting in the spring, someone says, and that keep you smiling and turning back, and that you must read aloud to someone. The pathetic aspect of things shown by a mere word or two that catches you unaware and makes a clutch at your throat, the world-old truth that strikes you anew because of its perfect and vital expression. It is chiefly when one reads for this joy and finds it that one realizes the time wasted on commonplace stuff. It has become the fashion in some quarters to decry Stevenson and Pater as affected and far-fetched and unreal. And there may be reason for the charge, but on the whole they do a good work for us in reminding us that there is magic in the how things are said. What if Stevenson did consciously write one page in the style of the 18th century and another in that of the time of James I, and write in Lamb's manner as well as Lamb himself? In so doing, he preached the importance of skill and deftness in handling one's tools, a doctrine somewhat needed in a generation whose vocabulary and construction grow more and more careless and show less and less pains. The fifth joy is that of expansion, to be caught out of our daily rut and be taken up where we get the bird's eye view, to see the kingdoms of the earth and their relation to us, to make friends in every land, of every tongue, and of every age. To escape from the steam-heated air of conventional respectability and soar among the great realities, to see, as by sudden intuition, the true proportion of things, and never to quite forget the lesson afterward, even to wallow for a bit with primitive beasts in their mire, just as an experience, and to help one understand, these things make one rise from a book, a changed being, with wider horizons, broader sympathies, deeper comprehensions, and no less firmer grip on the essentials, because the non-essentials have been classified as such at last. The epoch-making books in science, the philosophy of history, great tragedies greatly written, novels that are faithful portrayals of other lands and other ideas, all of these open doors to a wider and sometimes a higher world. The people who like only one kind of book, and won't even try any other kind, who read only to confirm their own opinions and prejudices, forever miss this exhilarating joy. Exploring, even in imagination, with one's feet on the hearthstone, and a fair certainty that eventually one's mind also will come home, has its adventures and even its dangers, and one is bigger and better for having passed through them. As I read of the courage and perseverance and pluck of Isabella Bird, of Mrs. Rowan, the flower hunter, of Mary Kingsley, and other women travellers and explorers, I find out what is wanting in my own make-up and have a better idea of comparative values. And though that may not be a joy, the admiration of my betters is decidedly one. As one reads Julius Caesar and King Lear and Hamlet, one has the joy of knowing that if one has not the mind of Shakespeare, at least one has enough to follow its thoughts and appreciate the wonder of it. and that is something, as Hans Andersen says. But I must get on with my joys, or they will be turned into mourning. The sixth joy is the opposite of the joy of sympathy, for it is the joy of shock. To most of us, it is an acquired taste, and it takes time to make shock into a joy, just as it does to make oneself willing to take hold of the handles of an electric battery after one experience. The paradoxical people that give shocks are likely to get on our nerves, and if we aren't of the minority who love, we are of the majority who hate, for there is no half-way attitude for most of us toward these electric authors. We either take them very seriously, or we turn up our noses at them as charlatans. They are not charlatans, but perhaps we may call them jugglers. They twist and turn the truth so that it has faces we never saw before, and either we think we have never seen truth at all until now, or because of its newness we refuse to recognize this one aspect of it. Their work is purely intellectual, so there is really nothing to get mad about, any more than there is about the juggler's trick that we can't see through. They have done something we couldn't do. They have shown us something, or pretended to show us something, we never saw before, and the thing for us to do is to take it for what it is worth as an exhibition and rejoice in the cleverness of it. And if we do make a joy of the shock we get, our mental circulation is quickened, and we feel so wide awake that the first thing we know, we are incurring again the risk of contact with the battery. These writers are particularly good for the people who constitutionally dislike them. By the time one has reached the point of finding joy in repeated shocks, the cure is pretty well effected, and one needs them no longer. One is now thoroughly stirred up, with the blood circulating to every finger end, and one can do some tricks oneself. The serious shocker who speaks his mind, like Ibsen, gets a readier hearing because people believe he is in earnest. They are not afraid that if they agree with him, he will suddenly say, "Over the left," and deny all he has just been converting them to. Besides, he can generally produce a lot of evidence, and doesn't ask you to take a new truth, or a new view of truth, on his unsupported word. The paradox maker is an irritant, and the serious shocker is a stimulant, and they are both good for a sluggish circulation. To people who are already sufficiently excitable, they are an intoxicant, and we have all seen people who have imbibed Bernard Shaw almost to the verge of DT. Time was when I would no more have taken a shock voluntarily than I would have walked up to a strange cow. But one or two experiences of the gasp and the tingling sensation proved that it didn't hurt, as the children say, and so I have come to put the shock among the joys of reading, a fearful joy to be sure, but nonetheless a joy. The last of the seven is the joy of revelation. Of course this does not belong to reading alone. Music, pictures, sculpture, architecture, drama, all contain the possibilities of revelation. Perhaps science in these days may be counted the great revealer. Between the sober, well-supported pillars that have become its foundation, one catches glimpses of visions, of dazzling hypotheses, of broken arcs of the perfect circle of floor, and one hears strains of music that seem to belong to other strains heard before, and to indicate a great harmony somewhere if our ears were only attuned to hear it. Through some sentence of apparently secondary importance, we catch sight of possibilities so great, so revolutionary, that we are a trifle dizzy. In fact, it is only snatches that we can bear such revelations, and they are gone before we can register them or know truly just what we have seen. But we realize that for one fleeting instant we have been rubbed out of the body, that we have seen with something other than the bodily eye or the eye of the mind. And the little intuitions we experience occasionally are to these great revelations, as 2 × 2 = 4 is to the calculus. Whether the writer knew when he penned his sentence that it would be an open sesame to those who read is doubtful. Is it not Emerson who says that there is inspired reading as well as inspired writing? One reads the same words at another time, and they produce no vision. One tries to analyze them to see where, through what opening, one had one's glimpse, and they are solidly welded together. But no number of failures and disappointments can ever convince one that there was no revelation. The experience was too keen, and the effect too overwhelming to be either denied or forgotten. As a rule, we look for revelation of this kind, if anywhere, in religious books, but we find it, or rather it finds us, for we seem to have nothing to do with it, through the pages of almost any book written in seriousness. Great as is the joy when it arrives, it is so rare that I almost feel I am wrong in placing among the joys of reading one that may come but once in a lifetime.
End of the Seven Joys of Reading by Mary Wright Plummer.
The Seven Reasons Why. Lyrics by Stanislaus Stanger. Music by Reginald de Koven. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org.
Oh, who can describe all the joys of a kiss? A difficult task, I declare. To understand fully its exquisite bliss, it never takes less than a pair. It's something that you all alone cannot do. You must have another's advice. 'Tis nothing for one, but divided by two, you'll find it will amply suffice. There are many reasons why this should be so. I'll give you 7, the best I know. Reason number 1, it is naughty but it's nice. And reason number 2, you would like it more than twice. Reason number 3, you'll adore it if you try. Reason number 4, for another you would die. Reason number 5, it was never known to pain. And reason number 6, you can take it back again. Reason number 7, if you do, you'll be in heaven. And that's the best of all the reasons why. Is ever the theme of our story and song, its praises all ages have sung. A double-faced action that no one thinks wrong, a pleasure to old and to young. Oh, who can describe its effect on the heart? No poet possesses the skill. When all they have said and exhausted their art, 'tis something which quite fills the bill. There are many reasons why this should be so. I'll give you 7, the best I know. Reason number 1, it is naughty but it's nice. And reason number 2, you would like it more than twice. Reason number 3, you'll adore it if you try. Reason number 4, for another you would die. Reason number 5, it was never known to pain. Reason number 6, you can take it back again. Reason number 7, if you do, you'll be in heaven. And that's the best of all the reasons why.
End of the 7 Reasons Why by Stanislaus Stanger and Reginald de Koven, sung by Ruth Golding.
Seven at One Blow by Wilhelm and Jakob Grimm. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A tailor sat in his workroom one morning, stitching away busily at a coat for the Lord Mayor. He whistled and sang so gaily that all the little boys who passed the shop on their way to school thought what a fine thing it was to be a tailor, and told one another that when they grew to be men, they'd be tailors too. "How hungry I feel, to be sure," cried the little man at last. "But I'm far too busy to trouble about eating. I must finish his lordship's coat before I touch a morsel of food. and he broke once more into a merry song. "Fine new jam for sale," sang out an old woman as she walked along the street. "Jam! I can't resist such a treat," said the tailor, and running to the door he shouted, "This way for jam, dame! Show me a pot of your very finest." The woman handed him jar after jar, but he found fault with all. At last he hit upon some to his liking.
"And how many pounds will you take, sir?"
"I'll take 4 ounces," he replied in a solemn tone, "and mind you, give me good weight." The old woman was very angry, for she had expected to sell several pounds at least, and she went off grumbling after she had weighed out the 4 ounces. "Now for a feed," cried the little man, taking a loaf from the cupboard as he spoke. He cut off a huge slice and spread the jam on, quite 1/2 inch thick. Then he suddenly remembered his work. "It will never do to get jam on the Lord Mayor's coat, so I'll finish it off before I take even one bite," said he. So he picked up his work once more, and his needle flew in and out like lightning. I am afraid the Lord Mayor had some stitches in his garment that were quite 1/4 inch long. The tailor glanced longingly at his slice of bread and jam once or twice, but when he looked the third time, it was quite covered with flies, and a fine feast they were having off it. This was too much for the little fellow. Up he jumped, crying, "So you think I provide bread and jam for you, indeed? Well, we'll very soon see. Take that!" And he struck the flies such a heavy blow with a duster that no fewer than 7 lay dead upon the table, while the others flew up to the ceiling in great haste.
7 at one blow," said the little man with great pride. "Such a brave deed ought to be known all over the town, and it won't be my fault if folks fail to hear of it." So he cut out a wide belt and stitched on it in big golden letters the words, "7 at one blow."
When this was done, he fastened it round him, crying,
"I'm cut out for something better than a tailor, it's quite clear. I'm one of the world's great heroes, and I'll be off at once to seek my fortune."
He glanced around the cottage, but there was nothing of value to take with him. The only thing he possessed in the world was a small cheese. "You may as well come too," said he, stowing away the cheese in his pocket. "And now I'm off." When he got into the street, his neighbors all crowded round him to read the words on his belt.
7 at one blow," they said to another. "What a blessing he's going! For it wouldn't be safe to have a man about us who could kill 7 of us at one stroke."
You see, they didn't know that the tailor had only killed flies. They took it to mean men. He jogged along for some miles until he came to a hedge, where a little bird was caught in the branches.
"Come along," said the tailor, "I'll have you to keep my cheese company." So he caught the bird and put it carefully into his pocket with the cheese.
Soon he reached a lofty mountain, and he made up his mind to climb it and see what was going on at the other side. When he reached the top, there stood a huge giant gazing down into the valley below.
"Good day," said the tailor.
The giant turned round, and seeing nobody but the little tailor there, he cried with scorn,
"And what might you be doing here, might I ask? You'd best be off at once."
"Not so fast, my friend," said the little man. "Read this."
7 at one blow," read the giant, and he began to wish he'd been more civil. "Well, I'm sure nobody would think it to look at you," he replied. "But since you are so clever, do this."
And he picked up a stone and squeezed it until water ran out.
"Do that? Why, it's mere child's play to me," and the man took out his cheese and squeezed it until the whey ran from it.
"Now who is cleverer?" asked the tailor. "You see, I can squeeze milk out, while you only get water."
The giant was too surprised to utter a word for a few minutes. Then, taking up another stone, he threw it so high into the air that for a moment they couldn't see where it went. Then down it fell to the ground again.
"Good," said the tailor. "But I'll throw a stone that won't come back again at all."
Taking the little bird from his pocket, he threw it into the air, and the bird, glad to get away, flew right off and never returned. This sort of thing didn't suit the giant at all, for he wasn't used to being beaten by anyone.
"Here's something you'll never manage," he said to the little man. "Just come and help me to carry this fallen oak tree for a few miles."
"Delighted," said the tailor, "and I'll take the end with the branches, for it's sure to be heavier."
"Agreed," replied the giant,
and he lifted the heavy trunk onto his shoulder, while the tailor climbed up among the branches at the other end and sang with all his might as though carrying a tree was nothing to him. The poor giant, who was holding the tree trunk and the little tailor as well, soon grew tired.
"I'm going to let it fall," he shouted,
and the tailor jumped down from the branches and pretended he had been helping all the time. "The idea of a man your size finding a tree too heavy to carry," laughed the little tailor.
"You are a clever little fellow, and no mistake," replied the giant. "And if you'll only come and spend the night in our cave, we shall be delighted to have you."
"I shall have great pleasure in coming, my friend," answered the little tailor. And together they set off for the giant's home. There were seven more giants in the cave, and each one of them was eating a roasted pig for his supper. They gave the little man some food, and then showed him a bed in which he might pass the night. It was so big that, after tossing about for half an hour in it, the tailor thought he would be more comfortable if he slept in the corner, so he crept out without being noticed. In the middle of the night, the giant stole out of bed and went up to the one where he thought the little man was fast asleep. Taking a big bar of iron, he struck such a heavy blow at it that he woke up all the other giants.
"Keep quiet, friends," said he. "I've just killed the little scamp."
The tailor made his escape as soon as possible, and he journeyed on for many miles until he began to feel very tired, so he lay down under a tree and was soon fast asleep. When he awoke, he found a big crowd of people standing around him. Up walked one very wise-looking old man, who was really the king's prime minister.
"Is it true that you have killed seven at one blow?" he asked.
"It's a fact," answered the little tailor.
"Then come with me to the king, my friend, for he's been searching for a brave man like you for some time past. You are to be made captain of his army, and the king will give you a fine house to live in."
"That I will," replied the little man. "It is just the sort of thing that will suit me, and I'll come at once." He hadn't been in the king's service long before everyone grew jealous of him. The soldiers were afraid that if they offended him, he would make short work of them all. While the members of the king's household didn't fancy the idea of making such a fuss over a stranger. So the soldiers went in a body to the king and asked that another captain should be put over them, for they were afraid of this one. The king didn't like to refuse, for fear that they should all desert, and yet he didn't dare get rid of the captain in case such a strong and brave man should try to have his revenge. At last the king hit upon a plan. In some woods close by there lived two giants, who were the terror of the countryside. They robbed all the travelers, and if any resistance was offered, they killed the men on the spot. Sending for the little tailor, he said,
"Knowing you to be the bravest man in my kingdom, I want to ask a favor of you. If you will kill these two giants, and bring me back proof that they are dead, you shall marry the princess, my daughter, and have half my kingdom. You shall also take 100 men to help you, and you are to set off at once."
100 men, your majesty? Pray, what do I want with 100 men?
If I can kill 7 at one blow, I needn't be afraid of 2. I'll kill them fast enough, never fear."
The tailor chose 10 strong men and told them to await on the border of the wood, while he went on quite alone. He could hear the giants snoring for quite half an hour before he reached them, so he knew in which direction to go. He found the pair fast asleep under a tree, so he filled his pockets with stones and climbed up into the branches over their heads. Then he began to pelt one of the giants with the missiles, until after a few minutes one of the men awoke. Giving the other a rough push, he cried,
"If you strike me again like that, I'll know the reason why."
"I didn't touch you," said the other giant crossly. And they were soon fast asleep once more.
Then the tailor threw stones at the other man, and soon he awoke as the first had done.
"What did you throw that at me for?" said he.
"You are dreaming," answered the other. "I didn't throw anything."
No sooner were they fast asleep again than the little man began to pelt them afresh. Up they both sprang, and seizing each other, they began to fight in real earnest.
Not content with using their fists, they tore up huge trees by the roots and beat each other until very soon the pair lay dead on the ground. Down climbed the little tailor, and taking his sword in his hand, he plunged it into each giant, and then went back to the edge of the forest where the 10 men were waiting for him. "They are as dead as 2 doornails," shouted the little man. "I didn't say that I had an easy task, for they tore up trees by the roots to try to protect themselves with, but of course it was no good. What were 2 giants to a man who had slain 7 at one blow?" But the men wouldn't believe it until they went into the forest and saw the 2 dead bodies lying each in a pool of blood, while the ground was covered with uprooted trees. Back they went to the king. But instead of handing over half his kingdom, as he had promised, His Majesty told the little tailor that there was still another brave deed for him to do before he got the princess for his bride. "Just name it, then. I'm more than ready," was the man's reply.
"You are to kill the famous unicorn that is running wild in the forest and doing so much damage. When this is done, you shall have your reward at once."
"No trouble at all, Your Majesty. I'll get rid of him in a twinkling." He made the 10 men wait for him at the entrance to the wood, as they had done the first time, and taking a stout rope and a saw, he entered the forest alone. Up came the unicorn, but just as it was about to rush at the man, he darted behind a big tree. The unicorn dashed with such force against the tree that its horn was caught quite fast, and it was kept a prisoner. Taking his rope, he tied it tightly around the animal, and after sawing off the horn, back he went to the palace, leading the unicorn by his side. But even then the king was not satisfied, and he made the little tailor catch a wild boar that had been seen wandering in the woods. He took a party of huntsmen with him, but again he made them wait on the outskirts of the forest while he went on by himself. The wild boar made a dash at the little tailor, but the man was too quick for it. He slipped into a little building close by, with the animal at his heels. Then, catching sight of a small window, he forced his way out into the forest again, and while the boar, who was too big and clumsy to follow, stood gazing at the spot where he had disappeared, the tailor ran round and closed the door, keeping the animal quite secure inside. Then he called the hunters, who shot the boar and carried the body back to the palace. This time the king was obliged to keep his promise, so the little tailor became a prince, and a grand wedding they had, too. When they had been married for about a couple of years, the princess once overheard her husband talking in his sleep. "Boy, if you have put a patch on that waistcoat, take the Lord Mayor's coat home at once, or I'll box your ears," he said.
"Oh, dear," cried the princess, "to think that I've married a common tailor! Whatever can I do to get rid of him?"
So she told her father the story, and the king said she need not worry, for he would find a way out of the difficulty. She was to leave the door open that night, and while the tailor was sleeping, the king's servants should steal into the room, bind the tailor, and take him away to be killed. The princess promised to see that everything was in readiness, and she tripped about all day with a very light heart. She little knew that one of the tailor's servants had overheard their cruel plot and carried the news straight to his master. That night, when the princess thought her husband was sleeping fast, she crept to the door and opened it. To her great terror, the tailor began to speak.
"Boy, take the Lord Mayor's coat home, or I'll box your ears. Haven't I killed 7 at one blow? Haven't I slain 2 giants, a unicorn, and a wild boar? What do I care for the men who are standing outside my door at this moment?"
At these words, off flew the men as though they had been shot from a gun, and no more attempts were ever made on his life. So the princess had to make the best of a bad job. He lived on, and when the old king died, he ascended the throne in his stead. So the brave little tailor became ruler over the whole kingdom, and his motto throughout his whole life was, 7 at one blow. End of 7 at one blow by Wilhelm and Jakob Grimm. Read by Winston Tharp.
"7 Years Old" by Algernon Charles Swinburne. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. 7 years old. 7 white roses on one tree, 7 white loaves of blameless leaven, 7 white sails on one soft sea, 7 white swans on one lake's lee, 7 white flower-like stars in heaven, all our types unmeet to be, for a birthday's crown of 7. Not the radiance of the roses, not the blessing of the bread, not the breeze that ere day grows, is fresh for sails and swans and closes wings above the sun's grave spread, when the starshine on the snows is sweet as sleep on sorrow shed. Nothing sweetest, nothing best, holds so good and sweet a treasure as the love wherewith one's blessed. Joy grows holy, grief takes rest, life, half-tired with hours to measure, fills his eyes and lips and breast with most light and breath of pleasure. As the rapture unpolluted, as the passion undefiled, by whose force all pains heart-rooted are transfigured and transmuted, recompensed and reconciled through the imperial undisputed present godhead of a child. Brown bright eyes and fair bright head, were the worthier crown than this is, were the worthier song instead, sweet grave wise round mouth full fed, with a joy of love whose bliss is more than mortal wine and bread, lips whose words are sweet as kisses, little hand so glad of giving, little heart so glad of love, little soul so glad of living, while the strong swift hours are weaving light with darkness woven above, time for mirth and time for grieving, plume of raven and plume of dove. I can give you but a word, warm with love therein for leaven, but a song that falls unheard, yet on ears of sense unstirred, yet by song so far from heaven, whence you came the brightest bird, 7 years since of 7 times 7. End of 7 Years Old by Algernon Charles Swinburne. The 7 Ages of Woman by Agnes Strickland. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The 7 Ages of Woman. Thou, whose bold genius in so short a span marked the 7 stages of the life of man, yet hast omitted in thy gifted page to paint the errors of his consort's age, lend me thy deathless spirit whilst I show each change of woman's days through weal and woe. First, soft and helpless, innocent and mild, smiles in her nurse's arms the female child, fresh from her maker's hands, all pure and fair, unstained by sin, unruffled yet by care, a stranger in this world of ceaseless strife, lovely and passionless her dawn of life. Next, see her seated at her mother's feet, with eyes upraised the glance of love to meet, gay as the birth of hope, all joy and grace, the mind expanding brightens in her face. Speech partially unlocked, in silvery tone, she now essays to make her wishes known, now to explain her doubtful meaning tries, with mingled eloquence of lips and eyes. Here the first sorrows of the child begin, the slumbering passions waken from within, each in its turn its growing strength reveals, anger and love and grief she keenly feels. With graver look and melancholy air, she cons the lesson with reluctant care, the book, the pen, the needle all engage, and form the sorrows of the second stage. A third advances, toils and tasks are past, and life's sweet summer brightly dawns at last. Spring's lovely buds expand to fairest flowers, and hope's enchantment gilds the sunny hours. She, by the standard of her own pure mind, judges the cold, the selfish, and unkind. Earth and its children views in trusting mood, and thinks that, like herself, they all are good. And blind to all its shoals and storms and strife, she enters on the treacherous waves of life. Ah, sweet confiding season over your bloom, why should the blight of falsehood cast a gloom? Over those high fillings and that heart's warm glow, a chilling dam the cruel world will throw. The noblest virtues which that mind adorn, the false will mock, the wicked treat with scorn. The crowd shall mark with cold invidious gaze, and those will trample who should help to raise, till from the freezing glance of heartless pride its fair endowment's slighted worth will hide. This, in the lovely dayspring of her youth, shall cloud its sunshine and abuse its truth. Or bitterer far, perchance, is doomed to prove the venomed shafts of unrequited love. At first, by slow degrees, her gentle heart admits the poison, nor perceives the smart. She loves the moonlight and the evening hour, the river's margin and the forest bower. There, wrapped in musings, she delights to stray, and nurse the dream that steals her soul away. All else to her is idle, dull, and vain, pleasure insipid, and exertion pain. Too oft is hers, by strangling pangs oppressed, to hide the thorn that rankles in her breast. With dying hopes to combat thronging fears, and find a sad relief in gushing tears, alas, she learns that cruel man can turn from hearts like hers, and each warm feeling spurn, that he unmoved can all her anguish view, and treat with cold contempt a love so true, so fond as hers, which worlds could never buy, and kings themselves to share might vainly sigh. She weeps in secret, and she sits alone, pale as a sunless day whose hope is gone, absorbed in silent, heart-consuming woe, reckless of all around, above, below. This cannot last, and time with noiseless wings sweeps over her bosom and allays its stings, and other hopes and calmer feelings brings. So pass the three first stages of her life. A fourth succeeds, and sees her now a wife. Yet not perchance of him who taught her heart the earliest sigh and caused its keenest smart, forgetful of the wrongs which man has given, when linked to man she makes his home a heaven. His nurse in sickness, and his joy in health, his aid in poverty, his pride in wealth, her heart the solace where his wounded mind flies for relief and finds it ever kind. Where, when all fail him, he can still confide its faith like gold, more pure the more 'tis tried. Though storms without on every side increase, they cannot mine the house of love and peace, which on the rock of duty firmly stands, while strife and folly perish on the sands. But now a period still more blessed shall come, and crown with joy the calm delights of home, the sweetest era of the female life, which makes a mother of the happy wife, and adds a cement to that holy tie, for human happiness ordained on high. When round her board the olive branches spring, and love's dear claimants to their mother cling, and she beholds beneath her anxious eyes her lovely hopes in fair succession rise, the youngest, cradled on her fostering breast, sighs its delight, and softly sinks to rest. Another darling, with bewitching grace, hides in the slumberer's robe his cherub face. Then archly wanton, full of infant glee, he laughs aloud, and peeps mamma to see. A third, more active, boldly climbs her chair, and pleads his right each fond caress to share. whilst a fair girl who hangs upon her arm, reaching each playful wile and early charm, in lisping tones her earnest wish has told, that she sweet baby on her lap may hold. The happy mother on her infant train gazes with transport which amounts to pain. A smile of rapture on her lip appears, but her soft eyes overthrow with tender tears, tears which even gazing seraphs might approve, the holy weepings of maternal love. Blessed in her duties, calmly glide away the busy hours of life's meridian day, till time advancing over the dial flings a darker shade, and that sad epoch brings that mournful stage of comfortless distress which sees her now in widowed loneliness, consumed by sorrow and oppressed with gloom. She sighs for refuge in the friendly tomb. Yet, as her glance upon her children falls, she starts in anguish, and that wish recalls. From mingled feelings now her eyes overflow, the mother's softness with the widow's woe, her bosom thrilling with an interest dear, which robs of bitterness the falling tear. Her rebel heart sinks lowly, and her mind bows to the will of heaven in grief resigned. Slowly but sure, life's sands declining flow in ceaseless course. What now remains to show of woman's days when all has passed away, that charmed the young, the thoughtless, and the gay, and the fair fabric tortoise in decay, when youth and health and strength and beauty's beam appear like traces of some distant dream, of which remembrance almost seems to fade, even from herself who fondly once surveyed those bright possessions, and in raptured tone exclaiming, exulting, "These are all my own." Now reft of all, faint, feeble, pressed with age, we mark her feelings in the last great stage. The feverish hopes, the fears, the cares of life no more oppress her with their torturing strife. The restless tumults of her early day have passed with beauty and with youth away. She, like some traveller who beholds the sun sinking before him ere his journey's done, regrets not now to lose its noontide power, but hails the coolness of the evening hour, and feels a holy and divine repose rest on her spirit in the twilight close. She, in her children's children, tastes again maternal pleasure and maternal pain, to them imparts the knowledge years have given, and points her hopes to soar with hers to heaven. What though her eyes are dark in age's night, serener, brighter burns the inward light, guiding the spirit by its sacred ray to cast its mortal thralls and cares away, and wait its summons to eternal day. End of The Seven Ages of Woman by Agnes Strickland.
In the Seven Woods by William Butler Yeats. Read for LibriVox.org by Casper Nyson. I have heard the pigeons of the seven woods make their faint thunder, and the garden bees hum in the lime tree flowers, and put away the unavailing outcries and the old bitterness that empty the heart. I have forgot a while Tara uprooted and new commoners upon the throne and crying about the streets and hanging its paper flowers from post to post, because it is alone of all things happy. I am contented, for I know that quiet wanders laughing and eating her wild heart among pigeons and bees, while that great archer, who but awaits his hour to shoot, still hangs a cloudy quiver over Parachna Lee. End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
Die Sonne will sich sieben Male spiegeln by Christian Morgenstern. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Die Sonne will sich sieben Male spiegeln, in allen unseren sieben Leibesgliedern, dass sie ihr siebenmal ihr Bild erwidern. Die Sonne will uns siebenmal entsiegeln. End of Die Sonne will sich sieben Male spiegeln, bei Christian Morgenstern. Read by Julia Niedermeyer. Von den Sieben Zechbrüdern by Ludwig Uhland. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Ich kenne sieben lustige Brüder, sie sind die durstigsten im Ort. Die schwuren höchlich, niemals wieder zu nennen ein gewisses Wort. In keinerlei Weise, nicht laut und nicht leise. Es ist das gute Wörtlein Wasser, darin doch sonst kein Arges steckt. Wie kommt's nun, dass die wilden Prasser dies schlichte Wort so mächtig schreckt? Merkt auf, ich berichte die Wundergeschichte. Einst hörten jene durstgen Sieben von einem fremden Zechkumpan, es sei am Waldgebirge drüben ein neues Wirtshaus aufgetan. Da fließen so reine, so würzige Weine. Um einer guten Predigt willen hätt keiner sich vom Platz bewegt, doch gilt es, Gläser gut zu füllen, dann sind die Burschen gleich erregt. Auf, lasset uns wandern, ruft einer dem andern. Sie wandern rüstig mit dem Frühen, bald steigt die Sonne drückend heiß, die Zunge lechzt, die Lippen glühen, und von der Stirne rinnt der Schweiß, da rieselt so helle vom Felsen die Quelle. Wie trinken sie in vollen Zügen, doch als sie kaum den Durst gestillt, bezeugen sie ihr Missvergnügen, daß hier nicht Wein, nur Wasser quillt. O fades Getränke, o ärmliche Schwänke! In seine vielverwobenen Gänge nimmt jetzt der Wald die Pilger auf, da stehen sie plötzlich im Gedränge, verworrenes Dickich hemmt den Lauf. Sie irren, sie suchen, sie zanken und fluchen. Derweil hat sich in finstre Wetter die schwüle Sonne tief verhüllt. Schon rauscht der Regen durch die Blätter, es zuckt der Blitz, der Donner brüllt. Dann kömmt es geflossen und endlich ergossen. Bald wird der Forst zu tausend Inseln, zahllose Ströme brechen vor. Hier hilft kein Toben, hilft kein Winseln, es muß hindurch der edle Chor. O gründliche Taufe, o köstliche Traufe! Vor Alters wurden Menschenkinder verwandelt oft in Quell und Fluss. Auch unsere sieben armen Sünder bedroht ein gleicher Götterschluss. Sie triefen, sie schwellen, als würden sie quellen. So mehr geschwommen als gegangen, gelangen sie zum Wald hinaus. Doch keine Schenke sehen sie prangen, sie sind auf geradem Weg nach Haus. Schon rieselt so helle vom Felsen die Quelle. Da ist's, als ob sie rauschen spräche. Willkommen, saubere Brüderschar. Ihr habt geschmähet, töricht freche, mein Wasser, das euch labend war. Nun seid ihr getränket, dass ihr daran denket. So kam es, dass die sieben Brüder das Wasser fürchteten hinfort, und dass sie schwuren, niemals wieder zu nennen das verwünschte Wort. In keinerlei Weise, nicht laut und nicht leise. End of Von den sieben Zechbrüdern bei Ludwig Uhland. Read by Julia Niedermeyer. Die sieben Wünsche by Johann Gottfried Herder. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Hätt ich sieben Wünsch in meiner Gewalt, was wünscht ich? Nicht Glück und Ehren mannigfalt, den schönsten, liebsten Aufenthalt, den wünscht ich. Der Wunsch ist in des Manns Gewalt, nicht Glück und Ehren mannigfalt, lieb ist der schönste Aufenthalt. Der zweite Wunsch in meiner Gewalt, was wünscht ich? Nie sei des Freundes Herz mir kalt, nie sei mir lieb und Leben alt, das wünsch ich. Der Wunsch ist in des Manns Gewalt, nie sei dein Herz dem Freunde kalt, nie sei uns lieb und Leben alt. Der dritte Wunsch, und er ist mein, was wünsch ich? An anderer Glück mich zu erfreuen, mit meinem Glück vergnügt zu sein, das wünsch ich. Der Wunsch ist unser insgemein, mit unserem Glück zufrieden sein, macht uns an anderer Glück uns freuen. Der vierte ist in meiner Gewalt, was wünsch ich? Ein frisches Herz, so langes Wald, bei Jugendkraft und Wohlgestalt, das wünsch ich. Der Wunsch ist in des Manns Gewalt, ein frisches Herz, so langes Wald, schafft Jugendkraft und Wohlgestalt. Der Wunsch ist jetzt in meiner Hand, was wünsch ich? Verachtend Vorurteil und Tand, zu leben für mein Vaterland, das wünsch ich. Der Wunsch ist in des Mannes Hand, verachtend Vorurteil und Tand, ist Menschheit unser Vaterland. Der sechste Wunsch in meiner Gewalt, was wünsch ich? Den süßen Ruhm, der nie verhallt, der aus dem Herzen widerschallt, den wünsch ich. Der Wunsch ist in des Manns Gewalt, der süße Ruhm, der nie verhallt, ist der aus Herzen widerschallt. Der letzte Wunsch in meiner Gewalt, was wünsch ich? Ist der, den kaum die Lippe lallt, ein stiller Wunsch, komm er mir bald. Des Herzens mächtigster Gewalt ist das, was kaum die Lippe lallt. Ein stiller Wunsch, komm er uns bald. End of Die sieben Wünsche bei Johann Gottfried Herder. Read bei Julia Niedermeyer. Die sieben Schwestern bei Karl Simrock. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Die sieben Schwestern, habt acht, wir könnten scheitern, da würden's acht. Sie trieben immer mit Liebe Spott, die Felsenherzen, das rächte Gott. Dort über Wesel, wo Schönberg ragt, da haben sie manchen Verliebten geplagt, erst angezogen, verlacht hernach und heimgesendet mit Hohn und Schmach. Hier sind sie versunken dafür im Rhein, in Fels verwandelt und harten Stein. Und wenn ein Schifflein vorüberfährt, das sei mit Spröden nun nicht beschwert. Die niemals liebte, sie muß herbei, daß bei den sieben die achte sei. Ist eine Spröde hier auf dem Schiff, so wird's zerschellen am Felsenriff. Wir dreie hätten nicht Schuld daran, denn wir sind Frauen und lieben den Mann. Das wollen wir hoffen, und wär es nicht wahr, wir alle schwebten in großer Gefahr. So bin ich eine verlobte Braut, die nie verlangend nach andern schaut. Das wollen wir hoffen, und wär es nicht wahr, wir alle schwebten in großer Gefahr. Ich bin noch ledig, doch will ich gestehen, dass ich den und jenen nicht ungern gesehen. Das wollen wir hoffen, und wär es nicht wahr, wir alle schwebten in großer Gefahr. Mit alten Jungfer spricht niemand Trost, doch dieses Hündchen mir freundlich kost. Das wollen wir hoffen, und wär es nicht wahr, wir alle schwebten in großer Gefahr. 12-Jährige. Dass ihr nicht jämmerlicher trinken müsst, hab ich heimlich des Nachbars Gottfriedchen geküsst. Das wollen wir hoffen, und wär es nicht wahr, wir alle schwebten in großer Gefahr. End of Die sieben Schwestern bei Karl Simrock. Read bei Julia Niedermeyer.
In the Seven Woods by W.B. Yeats. This is recorded to celebrate the 7th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. I have heard the pigeons of the seven woods make their faint thunder, and the garden bees hum in the lime tree flowers, and put away the unavailing outcries and the old bitterness that empty the heart. I have forgot awhile Terra uprooted, and new commonness upon the throne, and crying about the streets, and hanging its paper flowers from post to post, because it is alone of all things happy. I am contented, for I know that Quiet wanders laughing and eating her wild heart among pigeons and bees, while that great archer, who but awaits his hour to shoot, still hangs a cloudy quiver over Park Na Lee. End of In the Seven Woods by W. B. Yeats.